Jelani. In the East African language of Swahili, Jelani means strength. And in June 1996, when Carmen and Sevi Day welcomed their fourth child into the world, they named him Jelani. He was the fourth of five children and the youngest of his parents' three sons. The Days reared their children in a small town and in a loving church family. Like so many families who worship in the Pentecostal tradition of the Church of God in Christ or Kojic, the Days emphasized reverence and kindness. And like so many Black families in this country, the Days taught their children the value of excellence and achievement. Jelani Day grew up hearing a message familiar to many. You have to be twice as good. Handsome, young, beloved, connected, Jelani, the little boy, now man, named for strength, was destined for great things. And at 25 years old, Jelani had already begun to do them. He attended and graduated from Alabama A&M University, a historically Black college in Huntsville, Alabama. There, he pledged Omega Psi Phi Fraternity, the nation's first fraternal organization founded on the campus of a historically Black college. And this fall, he enrolled in graduate school at Illinois State University with the goal of pursuing a career in speech pathology. In August, Jelani Day went missing. Jelani's car was found a couple of days after he was reported missing, and it had no license plates or keys. 10 days later, Jelani's body was found in the Illinois River. He was 60 miles from his campus in a town where less than 1% of the population is African American and where he's had no known connections. Jelani was found in a river, but he was an avid swimmer who competed on his school's swim team. It took the local coroner's office more than 3 weeks to identify Jelani's body and notify his family. The family ordered a second independent autopsy and said in a statement on Facebook that there are contradicting facts between the preliminary autopsy and the second one. And because of this contradiction, the family is in the process of ordering a third autopsy. Here is Jelani's mother, Carmen Bolden Day, in an interview with CNN at the end of September. She's talking about how the local police have handled the investigation.
To them, Jelani didn't mean anything. There's no effort, there's no push, there's no nothing that was being done about my son. I did all that legwork, me and my kids, me and everybody that never knew Jelani, my family, friends, strangers, did all the legwork. My son didn't get any type of help. And I'm pissed.
Police are continuing to investigate Jelani's death, but his family members and his fraternity at Alabama A&M University and local advocates, well, they all have concerns over Bloomington Police Department's handling of the case, and they're asking for federal investigators to intervene and take over. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and the story of Jelani Day is where we begin today's episode of The Takeaway. With me is Linda Foster, president of the Bloomington Normal NAACP chapter. Welcome to the show, President Foster.
Thank you so much.
And also here is James Wright, assistant professor at Florida State University, specializing in policing. Welcome to you as well, Professor Wright.
Thank you for having me.
Now, as we start our conversation, I want to acknowledge that so much of what I said here at the start about Jelani and about his life has been reported this month in a multi-article series penned by John Fountain of the Chicago Sun-Times. And Professor Wright, I want to start with you here because it was genuinely difficult to find real human information about Jelani and not just like the statistics about him. And I wonder about the ways that we don't talk about Black victims with the same kind of humanity and fullness that we often see with other victims.
Yeah, I think it's really important to acknowledge that. I think, you know, when we think about Black victims, we don't humanize them enough and we only see them as a statistic. And when you think about the issue with Jelani, you know, he was trying to be somebody in terms of he was trying to do something more with his life. He was trying to elevate himself. And yet we see that the continual narrative within society is that this is just another Black boy lost. And so I think it's important for us to recognize the humanistic element that comes with it when we think about Black boys and Black men that are missing or unidentified. And we really think about the human impact that it has, not just on himself, but on his family. And we heard it from the first audio that you played when his mother was crying for the police to help. And I think this is just emblematic of a bigger problem with the relationship between the police and communities of color.
Ms. Foster, let me come to you on that, because I find it difficult to hear the pain in the voice of Jelani's mother, Mrs. Day. Have you been working with the family? And I'm wondering what you know about how they're feeling and about how the broader community is feeling in Bloomington right now.
You know, as a mother, I can only imagine the pain and the anguish that this family is going through. It doesn't take much to know that he was loved, he was valued, and that he will be truly, truly missed. Our interactions, I've met Miss Day and the siblings, and yet, the ideas that the things that they are facing. I live right here in the Bloomington Normal area. And to know that all of us have a responsibility to help this family do whatever we can to let them know that we are here and that we care about what is happening and that we don't want anyone else have to face what they're facing today. And so you asked me about our interaction. We're here and we have made ourselves available and will continue to be that help as they will allow us to be.
Professor Wright, let me come to you on this. I you know, this is one of those stories that the facts were changing a bit. We're kind of watching it in national news. We're trying to figure out what's happening. And I was thinking that, you know, even over the weekend, there was the story of the African-American woman who was found in the back of a police van. And I got to say, like, my first impulse was, oh, my goodness, you know, had she been left there by the police? You know, surveillance video seems to say that's not what happened. But I'm wondering about how all of these kinds of stories really seem to reinforce a sense of the lack of humanity, right? Just that Black people, Black families, Black communities are hurting, are sad, are worried, are concerned for our loved ones.
I think you hit it spot on, right? The lack of humanity that exists when we think about the relationship that exists traditionally, historically, and concurrently now with the police and Black communities, I think part of this is the notion that, you know, we don't exist as humans and we are just seen as expendable within society from the standpoint from police officers sometimes. And I think this leads to a broader narrative that, like, what sort of relationship should exist between the police and the community? And it doesn't have to be antagonistic. But when we see examples of Jelani, we see examples of David Robinson, a boy that went missing in Arizona. We see examples of Keisha Jacobs. She had been missing in 2016, and the police said that she'd probably just ran away. I think the lack of attention to the humanistic element when it comes to the Black community is what triggers a lot of these emotions. And historically, if we don't have the best relationship to begin with, this is just deepening the tension and the frustration that exists between the police and the community.
Mrs. Foster, what can you tell us about the existing relationship between this police department and the community that you in part serve at the NAACP?
Thank you so much for asking that question. We have several police departments. As I stated earlier, Bloomington Normal. Bloomington has its own police department, Bloomington, the police department. And then we have Normal Police Department. Then we have Illinois State University police department, and then we have our sheriff department. So there's many agencies within this Central Illinois community. The relationship is a work in action. And what I mean by that, we are constantly rebuilding and building on our relationships by having a different vehicles in which we can come together for the greater good. We have an organization called MAP, Minority and Police Partnership, in which we meet quarterly, every other month, as needed, to have these conversations, have these hard conversations about relationship building of our community. The other piece is that we know these individuals. We know the chief of police of all of these agencies. And so we have a relationship that we can take time out to have the conversations about how do we better have a community that is one community. I said four agencies, but it's still one community. And so you constantly have to work at it so that we are being the community in which we all can be proud of. Now, you know, it's not perfect. No, it's not. But we have some solid ground here that we're working on. And so I appreciate the relationships that we have built in our community, and that we will continue to harvest the ideas of making our community one that one feels comfortable in, one feels safe in, and one feels as though that they can make a difference in.
Professor Wright, you know, I hear from President Foster there this, you know, desire to build relationship. Can you help us to understand, just sort of from a national or even historic perspective, if this kind of timeline in Jelani's case is typical when we're talking about a missing person and a recovered body, or was this long?
So I think with Jelani's case, it was a little bit longer than usual. Oftentimes, we'll see that there is more local detail that's put into finding a missing person case. And I think Jelani's case is emblematic of other cases of Black individuals that have gone missing. So I think it was a little bit longer than usual. I think it's a good idea for them to involve state and federal entities to help them think through the case of Jelani and other cases as well.
Now, because of the ways local authorities have handled the case, Day's family and friends have requested assistance from federal authorities. I want to just play you a clip for a moment of Jelani Day's mother in an interview with CNN.
Him and my youngest daughter, they both are going to be doctors. Dr. Jelani Day, Dr. Zaina Day. They have this competition with each other to make sure their GPAs stay up. My son wasn't involved in the streets. He wasn't a gangbanger. He wasn't nothing. But I guess if that could have been their narrative, then it would have been, oh, let's forget about him. But he was a productive citizen. I raised a good young man.
Still with me are Linda Foster, president of the Bloomington Normal NAACP, and James Wright, who is assistant professor at Florida State University. Dr. Wright, what does it mean that Jelani's mother felt she had to describe her son as a good young man?
You know, it's unfortunate that in society, when something happens to somebody that identifies as Black or Black American, that the first thing we always have to mention is that they weren't a gangbanger, they weren't doing drugs, they weren't selling drugs, because the assumption is in American society that if they're Black, they're up to no good. And I think it's something that happens too often when I think about myself, when I think about other individuals that are, you know, in the academic spaces or these other corporate spaces, we automatically have to tell people, listen, we're not a threat to your humanity, as well as you shouldn't be a threat to my humanity. So the fact that she had to mention that without the preconceived notion that he's not just reiterates how society views Black Americans. And it's just sad at this point.
President Foster, I know that your organization, the Bloomington Normal NAACP, along with other community members, have been holding events and rallies for Jelani Day. Do you think that community leaders are listening? Do you think that your police, who you've been working to build these relationships with, are listening?
I think that they are in a position whereas they are doing the best that they can. We are just a community that doesn't have these events that happen often. And yes, you know, we can do better. You know, law enforcement can do better at communicating with the families. They can do better with the man force, you know, putting enough of this attention to what's going on right now. They can do better at training. You know, how do you address these issues and not just wait till it happens? Our law enforcement, I believe, are in a position that they can only go up from here. And that it's unfortunate that we still deal with the issues of what matters, what life matters. Black lives do matter. And that it is important, it is imperative that all law enforcement is aware of this. And that we as a community have to be more impactful in making sure that they do know that. And that we do care. And that our loved ones are valued. There's a long history of why police are police. And it was because of us during slavery time. So we want to take that narrative and change it so that policing is supposed to be for all. But the first word in policing is serve. Serve its members of its community. So we would like to continue this conversation, come up with ways as a community to better help instruct on how the process should work, and that it should work for every individual, not just white women. And I have to say that because they get it right for them. They need to get it right for us as well.
That that point that you make about the fact that they can get it right. Professor Wright, let me come to you on this because I know that you too have been working to address community policing relationships in communities where you are in Florida. Can you talk to me about what some of those programs look like and whether or not they're moving these police forces towards getting it right?
Yeah, so we know that historically in Florida, and in particular, thinking about the South with these slave patrols, that there's a very negative perception of police officers because of the founding. So what we're doing in Florida actually is sort of reconciling and thinking through the history of the police departments. And in particular, thinking about in Florida, thinking about in Tallahassee, how can we change this narrative so that police forces can understand the sort of predatory nature that they have had and this antagonistic nature with Black people in Florida, and in particular Tallahassee. So we're working with our local sheriff and we're trying to get our local PD to implement these sort of history classes to understand what happened in Tallahassee, the history of policing, so that in the hopes that it can improve police relationships. Because if we don't reconcile with that history, if we don't start thinking about institutionalization of things, institutionalization of racism, systemic racism, we'll never have a police force that will truly be equitable for all. So that's one of the things we're doing with the sheriff's department here in Tallahassee.
James Wright is an assistant professor at Florida State University, working both in the academy and on the ground to do work around policing. And Linda Foster is the president of the Bloomington Normal NAACP and said so clearly what we needed to hear this morning. Black lives do matter. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this opportunity to share with the community and then your listeners. We understand that there are racial disparities in everything that Black and brown people are involved in. But we're on this battlefield. The NAACP is on this battlefield to make it more equitable.
On Monday, jury selection began in the trial of 67-year-old Gregory McMichael, 35-year-old Travis McMichael, and 52-year-old William Bryan, the three white men accused of murdering Ahmaud Arbery in February 2020. While Arbery was jogging near his home in Georgia, the McMichaels and their neighbor, Bryant, followed the 25-year-old and shot him to death from the back of their pickup truck. Video of the event was released and circulated widely on social media in the summer of 2020. Only now, more than a year later, is the trial beginning for these three men. We're joined now by Nicole Lewis, senior editor of Jurisprudence and Slate. Nicole, it's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So remind us of who Ahmaud Arbery was and what happened to him.
So he was a young black man out for a run, as he did on many occasions in his own neighborhood, when he was pursued and ultimately killed. And, you know, accounts of him put him as a fun, loving guy. He was a former football player, just a sort of all-American person.
So clearly this slaying occurred at the same, you know, very close to the murder of George Floyd. And I'm able to say the murder of George Floyd because we've gone through an entire process of a trial and conviction of former officer Derek Chauvin. Why is it taking so long for this trial to begin?
That's right. I mean, I think it's even important to back up and say it took long for the McMichaels and Bryan to be indicted, right? For many months, they went free and a prosecutor suspected no wrongdoing in this case. And so that ultimately delays justice. And here we are again, where there were so many missteps. The prosecutor ultimately stepped down, right? It was turned over to another governing body. There were just so many missteps in bringing this case before a court. And so now here we are a year later. With jury selection set to begin, and even jury selection is likely going to be a lengthy process.
Why?
I mean, I think that it reflects a lot about the sentiments or the attitudes in our country in terms of how do we think about when a crime happens. And so in Georgia in particular, the McMichaels say that they were trying to conduct a citizen's arrest, right? So this is in Georgia statute, allows someone to pursue any person they think is in the process of committing a felony. And so there was some legal ambiguity about when you kill someone dead in the street without a trial, without, you know, any other justification than you believing that they're committing a crime, do you get indicted? Is this actually illegal? And so there was just some big question about that. And now we are, this case becomes a test of that law and to see if, you know, we understand that extrajudicial killings like this are considered legal or justified.
So how critical will jury selection be in this case?
Absolutely. So critically important here. And so this is a case that received both widespread national attention as well as local attention. This is something that you could not have missed when it happened, right? It was all over social media. People were talking about it. National news, local news were writing about it. And so it's very unlikely that the jury who selected doesn't know any of the details of this case. I think many people are looking to see, will this jury be selected in an unbiased manner? Will there be black people who are able to judge? Will it be a jury of his peers? What will this look like? Someone pointed out to me yesterday that the community itself is a sort of a naturally occurring retirement community. So it tends to skew a little bit older, and older people tend to be a little bit more conservative. It also has a racial mix in which the town of Brunswick is majority black, but the surrounding county is not majority black. And so there's just a big question about who will show up and what this jury will look like.
All right, Nicole, can you tell us a bit about what the expectations are relative to the prosecution? What approach are they planning to take?
So the prosecution wants to make the case that this was a racially motivated killing, that the men pursued Arbery, that they killed him particularly precisely because he was black, that they thought that he fit the profile of someone who had committed a string of burglaries, and so that they were somehow justified in in, you know, in their minds, in pursuing him and killing him. So that this is a racially motivated crime, and that they were not acting in self-defense, and that what we saw was akin to a murder. That is what the McMichaels and Brian are charged with. And so that's the case that the prosecution is trying to make.
Do you have a sense of the ways that so maybe there's no trial that's been quite like this, but certainly there have been, sort of stand your ground kinds of killings or castle doctrine killings where a homeowner has killed someone who they perceive to be, or who maybe actually is in the case of potentially robbing them or stealing from their home or their business. Do we have any sense of how those tend to go in Georgia?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very tricky. So the stand your ground law was weakened in the wake of the Arbery killing. And so it no longer has quite the same teeth or wide berth as it did when he was shot. But these are very tricky cases because the stand your ground laws basically mean that you do not have to try to flee or get away, or you don't have to show that you were acting in self-defense and then when things took a turn, you tried to escape first, right? You are entitled to standing your ground, to shooting back, right? To acting in an expanded kind of self-defense. And so it becomes really tricky, especially when you lack any kind of video evidence that and the person, the victim is dead, they can't share their side of the story. So these are very difficult cases. In this case, it's very important to point out that we actually do have video footage. So that changes the balance just a bit.
And so say a bit more about that. How do you expect the prosecution to use this footage? And do we expect the defense potentially to also use the footage in some way?
Absolutely. So, video footage is open to interpretation as well. And so the key argument that the defense is trying to make is that the McMichaels and Brian acted in self-defense, that Arbery attacked them first, that this was not a racially motivated shooting. And so the video becomes really the pivotal thing that both sides of cases hangs on. And so the video shows a struggle, it shows the shooting, right? It shows that the McMichaels and Brian pursued Arbery and that he tried to get away. And so I think that both sides are going to try to hang their argument on what this footage shows. And it's not perfectly clear. It's not a view of the entire altercation. There's also some question of whether or not the McMichaels used a racial slur, right? And whether or not that's caught on video. And so I think they're just still, even with this evidence, there are big, big questions about what it shows and whose side does it truly support.
Let me ask about what's already happened in Georgia as a result, which is the passage of hate crime legislation. Do you expect that whether we get guilty or not guilty verdicts in this case, that it will make any difference in the sort of broader legislative aspects of the movement for racial justice?
I think that's a really important question, sort of the question that's hanging over this trial. And I just want to say that I spoke to an organizer down in Georgia, just yesterday, and she made really clear that there are actually some bigger economic and political shifts that need to be made in this community in order for the people there to feel like they've really achieved some semblance of racial justice. So no matter the outcome of the trial, there are some underlying factors that she pointed out that make a killing like this even possible. And so without big changes, without more people, more Black people in particular, making more money, having more opportunity, being registered to vote, being able to vote, having politicians who reflect their interest, her concern was that even if you did get a guilty verdict, that something like this could easily happen again.
Nicole Lewis is senior editor of jurisprudence at Slate. Thank you so much for joining us.
Very good to be with you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
On Saturday, a gang in Haiti kidnapped a group of 17 Christian missionaries, mostly Americans, who were visiting an orphanage. Five of the captured are children. Now, this particular gang was also responsible for the kidnappings of 10 Catholic clergy members back in April, and those clergy were released after about 2 weeks. The Haitian police force is weak, and while FBI agents have traveled to Haiti for support, they can only provide guidance but can't directly negotiate with the gangs. As of this morning, the gang was seeking $17 million in ransom, $1 million for each person they'd abducted. Haiti has the world's highest number of kidnappings per capita, and according to the United Nations Integrated Office, there have been 328 in the first 8 months of this year. Let's talk with Jacqueline Charles, Caribbean and Haiti correspondent for the Miami Herald. Jacqueline, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So first, tell me a bit about this gang.
So this gang, which is known as Katsa Mauzo or 400 Mauzo, they control a large part of the territory just east of Port-au-Prince, along a very well-traveled road that connects the Haitian capital to the Dominican Republic border. It is an area that is rural, so there are large plains. So even if police know where they're holding the Americans and the one Canadian, the reality is that they won't be able to access it. Every time police have tried to go in there, the gang is aware. Police have not been able to make arrest of some of its more active leaders, although one of its leaders is currently in the prison. But I'm told by sources that he remains active on the scene. So this is a gang that's well known because, you know, what they do in terms of kidnappings, they're not just kidnapping an individual person here or there, but they're kidnapping people by the busloads, the carloads, the vanloads. And this is what we saw in this incident, in this case with the 17 missionaries.
Now, I presume that the kidnappings are primarily to raise revenue. Is that a fair assumption?
It's a fair assumption that they're motivated by money and not political ideology. But the question is, where does that money go? You know, Haiti is a country that is under a U.S. arms embargo. So theoretically, right, there shouldn't be arms. There shouldn't be heavy ammunition. But this is, of course, a serious problem because these gangs are better armed than the Haitian National Police.
Okay. Now, the group that was abducted in April, priests and nuns primarily, was there a ransom paid for their release?
You know, officially they've said that there was no ransom paid, but I've heard through, you know, sources who monitor gang activity that there was a ransom that was paid. They were held for almost 2 weeks. And in that group, they also included French nationals. But in this case, as you're going to see in the United States, or in the case of the U.S., you know, the negotiations with the gang is not necessarily with the institutions the individuals represent, but with their family members. Because the institutions have been very careful, especially the Catholic Church in Haiti, not to be involved in this whole idea of paying ransom because it creates a vicious cycle.
Help us again to understand when we say gangs and Haitian gangs, what we're talking about here and the role that they play, particularly in this kind of, you know, moment of political crisis and post-earthquake. Who are they?
You're talking about mainly young men in their 20s, some even younger, who come from very poor neighborhoods, slums. They don't really have any prospect of the future. So they made themselves available to the patronages of the business elite who are trying to secure their monopolies or trying to get one up on competition. They made themselves available to politicians who want to win re-election, run for office, or remain in power. But we're also talking about former police officers, and in some cases, active cops, you know, bad cops, who have now joined these gangs or are part of them. One of the country's most notorious and well-known leaders is a guy by the name of Jimmy Cherizier, who goes by the moniker Barbecue. He's a former cop who's been implicated in several massacres, including one in a poor neighborhood in Port-au-Prince, where you have scores of people who were killed, including babies. Though he is wanted by the Haitian National Police, though he has been sanctioned by the U.S. government, he continues to walk freely. And in fact, on Sunday, when armed men prevented the country's acting prime minister from paying homage to the memory of assassinated founding father Jean-Jacques Dessalines at a monument, hours later, Barbecue appeared dressed in white like a government official, and he laid his wreath of flowers. This is what you're talking about.
Okay. What does that tell you then about the likely condition that the missionaries are in? Do we think that they're relatively safe? Do you expect this to be completed in a way that ultimately doesn't lead to immediate violence against the missionaries?
Let me tell you, this is a very nerve-wracking and frightening process. For those of us who cover Haiti on a consistent basis, we actually shy away from writing about people when they are being held in captivity because we just don't know. Every case is different. I mean, in the case of the Catholic clergy from earlier this year, when they were finally freed, they said that they were not mistreated despite the reports that were coming out at the time. You had among them some of them who did speak Creole, but there are cases where I've interviewed victims of kidnapping, and it's horrible, some of the things that have happened with them. One can only hope that in this case, because we're talking about foreign nationals, that the gang will use some sense of reasonableness. You know, the question that Haitians are asking themselves is that when they stopped that vehicle at gunpoint, and they saw that these were foreigners, why didn't they just walk away? Why did they not let it go? How did they become so emboldened? Because the reality is that hundreds and hundreds of Haitians have been victims of kidnapping, even more than what the United Nations has said, because it's an underreported crime in many instances. And so far this year, the tally that we have for foreigners, including this group, is about 42. But, you know, normally when you're talking about foreigners, gangs don't want that kind of scrutiny. They don't want to deal with the embassies or the, you know, the capitals of Washington and Paris. But we're seeing with this particular gang, Katsama Ozo, that they have become increasingly emboldened in terms of who they take hostages, how they take and how many they take. Unlike other gangs in the capital that are very much heavily involving kidnappings as well, this particular gang, you know, in order to avoid scrutiny, what they will do is that they will kidnap by the carload or the busload. But in one day, they can grab 6-7 vehicles. Mm-hmm. So instead of making $200,000 a pop by ransoming someone, they can make that amount of money in a day by ransoming several vehicles that they've grabbed.
Jacqueline, so given what we've seen at the U.S. southern border with the treatment of Haitian migrants, many of whom have been migrating across South and Central America since the earthquake years ago at this point. The situation you just described to me sounds like the kind of moment when we end up with massive refugee situations coming out of nations. Is there a reason to think that that may happen in Haiti, that we'll see a flood of people seeking protection and shelter from this violence?
It is happening. They're not arriving at the Florida Straits as we are used to seeing because of the Coast Guard, but they're arriving in the Bahamas. They're arriving in the Turks and Caicos. I mean, what we've been reporting in the last couple of weeks is that the Haitian migration crisis isn't just a U.S.-Mexico border crisis. It's a Latin America and Caribbean crisis. We're seeing Haitians all the way in Guyana. And what particularly is happening in the case of the earthquake is that those individuals desperate to get out, desperate for some kind of help, they're now being targeted by traffickers who are basically having them pay hundreds, thousands of dollars in some cases, get on a boat, only to turn around days later and to end up back in Haiti because they get caught or they break down on a reef in the Bahamian waters. We've even had Haitians end up in Cuba. So we are starting to see this crisis. Everybody's been focused on Del Rio, but the reality is while those individuals in Del Rio don't want to go back to a country that they no longer recognize and they left maybe 10, 11 years ago, there are people today who are leaving, trying to either get to the United States or get somewhere else in this region.
Do you have a clear sense of the ways that the international community could effectively intervene to address this level of gang violence. And at this point, even the vulnerability of foreign nationals traveling on mission in a Catholic country.
Well, you know, what's interesting, Haiti is under travel for warning from the United States, right? But that doesn't really make a difference, because when you talk to people, missionaries, you know, they're committed to the work that they're doing. They understand that they are, you know, providing a service in a country where people are poor, where the government doesn't exist and there are no services. But today, that is the question in terms of the international community that has sort of been dancing around this issue of Haiti, saying, oh, there's Haiti fatigue. But the reality is, if the U.S. government and others in the international community are not proactive and figure out what their response is going to be to assist Haiti to deal with this violence, to deal with this surge in gang violence, then it's going to reach a moment, unfortunately, where they're going to run out of options. And, you know, today there are several debates or several options that have been thrown out. All of them are problematic. You know, a return of UN peacekeepers, U.S. military involvement, special forces or private contractors. But, you know, nobody wants to pull the plug and make a decision. And when you talk to Haitians, what they tell you is time is running out.
Jacqueline Charles is Caribbean and Haiti correspondent for the Miami Herald. As always, Jacqueline, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Go forth to make this an even more perfect union. Go forth and raise strong families. And remember that all you can ever leave behind is your reputation, your good works, and your children for the next generation.
As we're coming toward the close of today's show, I want to switch gears just a bit. Colin Powell, the first Black United States Secretary of State, passed away on Monday due to complications from COVID-19. He was 84 years old. Powell, a four-star Army general, was also the first Black National Security Advisor and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The son of Jamaican immigrant parents, Powell was born in Harlem and raised in the South Bronx. And when asked in 1992 who his biggest influences were, he did not hesitate.
I always have to start out by saying my parents, two wonderful Americans, Jamaican Americans, who lived a good life, who raised a fine family.
It was his nearly 60-year marriage to his beloved Alma that brought him the most joy. Colin and Alma were married less than a year after they went on their first date, and just before he was sent off to Vietnam. Powell would return a new father, crafting a military career where he would move up the ranks, making a name for himself along the way. And yes, it's the one moment in that groundbreaking career while serving as the first Black Secretary of State that so many of us remember.
What you will see is an accumulation of facts and disturbing patterns of behavior. The facts and Iraq's behavior demonstrate that Saddam Hussein and his regime have made no effort to disarm as required by the international community.
General Powell was an almost universally trusted figure when he made the case to the United Nations, and it was his reputation that added significant credibility to evidence which we now know was wildly inaccurate. The president was determined, the U.S. Congress was in broad agreement, and many in the post-9/11 American public were supportive of the invasion of Iraq. But it is important to acknowledge that it was the testimony of this trusted soldier which helped launch the U.S. into the Iraq War. The conflict lasted a decade and claimed thousands of American lives and hundreds of thousands of Iraqi lives. In the years after his tenure, Secretary of State Powell would speak of his regret for his involvement in the ramp-up to war.
I regret it now because the information was wrong. Of course I do. But I will always be seen as the one who made the case before the international community.
I try to avoid this war.
It is a blot on my record. But, you know, there's nothing I can do to change that blot.
In later years, Powell kept a toe in the political waters, though he did so from the periphery. But in 2008, he surprised many with his endorsement for President of the United States. Here he is on Meet the Press.
I come to the conclusion that because of his ability to inspire, because of the inclusive nature of his campaign, because he is reaching out all across America, because of who he is and his rhetorical abilities, and we have to take that into account, as well as his substance. He has both style and substance. He has met the standard of being a successful president, being an exceptional president. I think he is a transformational figure. He is a new generation coming into the world, onto the world stage, onto the American stage. And for that reason, I'll be voting for Senator Barack Obama.
Powell was deeply committed to the American ideal and the next generation of leaders. An alum of the City College of New York, in 1997, he established the Colin Powell Center for Policy Studies, which would later be called the Colin Powell School of Civic and Global Leadership. Here's how the dean of that school remembered Powell during an interview with Fox 5 New York.
He really believed to his core in what we're doing in providing an education to all people, particularly of New York City. You know, we're 50% immigrants. We are 75% the first in their families to go to college, 80% people of color.
In reflecting on the passing of Congressman John Lewis last year, General Powell had this to say on Face the Nation.
Most of my life now is spent on education of young people and helping out my fellow citizens who are on the lower economic scale. And how do we get them up? We have to now move on to new things and not just slogans. And we have to make sure that we are putting everything we can into the needs of our fellow citizens, whatever they may be, whoever they may be, in order to bring them back into the world, into America, and make sure they have the same opportunity that John Lewis wanted all of us to have.
General Powell's legacy is not unblemished. He made costly mistakes that he was unable to remedy by apology alone. And as we mark his passing, we know that the takeaway of Colin Powell's long life of service is complex and powerful, like the man himself. General Colin Powell, the first Black Secretary of State, gone at the age of 84. We extend our deepest sympathies to the Powell family at this time. We asked about your thoughts on the man and his legacy.
The first time I heard Colin Powell speak was in the late 80s, and I would have voted for him for president after that day. It's so unfortunate to know that after such a committed and intelligent person had to quit his conservative party.
Hi, it's Brooke Joseph from San Mateo, California. I very much admired Colin Powell. I believe in public service, and I think he was one of the best modern examples that we have.
My name is Keith Billman from Salem, Oregon. And over the years, I developed a very healthy respect for Colin Powell right up until the second Iraq War. I still have a lot of respect for Colin Powell, but it will always be, yes, lots of respect, but. And at least he had the courage to admit he was wrong.
This is Andy Weiner from Charleston, South Carolina, and Colin Powell was a man who cared about the country and never put his own ambition above honesty. He was an honest broker of the truth, and that could be used a lot today.
Hey, it's Mark Hooper in Little Rock, Arkansas. Colin Powell, to me, was the embodiment of what every politician, statesman, should be.
Hi, my name is Roxanne. I'm calling from Los Angeles. And we lost a great American in Colin Powell. We lost a statesman and we lost a stable person in the community, in our American community, where we really need that guidance and wisdom more than ever now. It is a great loss and we should all be in mourning.
Hi, this is Dee from Yonkers, New York. It is an immensely sad day for me today. When I think about Secretary of State Powell, I think of a person whose footsteps I walked in. As a child of immigrants from the Caribbean, as a Black child growing up in the Bronx, as a person who has had the opportunity to be the first in many different situations, he and I both had heavy, heavy weights to bear. But he took that and shouldered that with class and grace and style and with a strength of character that people understood to know that although he was graceful, although he did have class, although he did carry himself with dignity, that he was not one to be trifled with. I can only hope to have the legacy, even just one part of the legacy that he has left behind. And for his family, for those who are close to him, I wish them nothing but peace. And for him, grace as he takes his final walk.
Thanks again for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry here on The Takeaway, and we'll talk again with you tomorrow.